Ms. Conrad, when you were a student in 1957 at UT, you were cast as Dido in a production of Dido and Aeneas by Henry Purcell. And UT pulled you from the production after a legislator from East Texas, where you grew up, objected to your being cast in the part. Now, what was the first thing that you felt when you were told that you weren't going to be singing the role of Dido?
It's something you can never forget. I mean, the idea that I would sing my very first opera ever was thrilling for me, as it would be for any student. But, you know, you fantasize about those things when you're a kid, when you're a young woman. And I was devastated. And I was also embarrassed for Dean Doty, because he was clearly having a difficult time telling me that. It was a lot of his initiative that got me involved in the first place. I had, in the music school, I had wonderful friends and colleagues and, you know, fellow students. And so I was pretty numb. And I don't remember saying very much of anything. I was stunned by it. He told me that they would prefer if I would just speak only to my parents about this situation, which was a ludicrous idea. And that was it. I was not to tell anyone but my parents, if possible.
Did you feel the music at the time? Because you said Dean Doty probably had a hard time breaking this to you. Did you feel the music faculty at the time was pretty much more colorblind, and that people were just really concentrating on the music?
I had an amazing group of teachers. They're some of my favorite teachers to this day. I knew deep in my heart, deep in my and recesses of my mind, which was certainly geared to understand what segregation was about. But you get lulled into thinking, oh, there's an aspect of, I guess, Shangri-La here. And we were good, you know, just like Carolyn Graves Good said last night, we were busy trying to be musicians. And I was hell-bent on getting to be a good musician because I didn't have that kind of background. We were lucky to get a music book, never mind a music teacher.
You had grown up, I guess, with your brother, I guess, is a big influence on you, you mentioned.
Not just my brother, but that whole community. There are a lot of wonderful singers, not necessarily trained, none of whom I think were trained. My sister had a little bit in her first 2 years of college. But it was all a matter of your gifts. And luckily, because Dinard was so geared towards classical music, it was a natural that I should. First of all, I worshipped him. We were about 2 years. There was 2 years in difference in our age, so it was my big brother, and I wanted to do everything he did.
You said that, of course, it was a ludicrous idea, and it was a ludicrous idea for you to only tell your parents about this. You know, you spoke on the record to it, to the Daily Texan at the time, and, of course, this wound up becoming a story in the Houston Post, and once the Houston Post picked it up, then it went national. And then soon Harry Belafonte was calling and saying, basically, you know, I'm going to pay your way to any other institute of higher learning you want to go to.
In the world. That was heady. Because I think most African American, well, certainly of my generation and even beyond, were all wanting to go to Fisk, which was the music school for African Americans. You know, that was like flying high, very high. And that was the one tug I had. But I'm also practical. I knew my parents didn't have money to send me to Fisk. It never occurred to me that he really meant paying my way until later, but that wouldn't have made any difference. It wasn't so much that I was even so angry at that point, because anger comes hard for me. I look for every way possible to resolve something without going there, because I find it destructive from my perspective. But I could not leave. I just couldn't. My pride, I felt entitled to go to the school that I knew that my parents could help me through that school, but I didn't understand how, well, even if I understood it, I just couldn't go.
And after you graduated, though, did you ever think that you would ever come back to Austin or to, let alone the University of Texas, for any reason?
No. And it wasn't so much I was so angry as I felt, why go to a place that treated you like that? It's like your lover let you down, that was it. Yeah. You know, and if someone said, I saw University of Texas in my rearview mirror, and that was it.
Well, you went on to have a great career with the New York City Opera, and boy, going on the stage at the Metropolitan Opera as well, which is a dream for any opera stars. But I was wondering if you could share with me how it was as an African-American woman to break into that world of opera, which...
Well, it, you know, racism was all over this country. Wasn't easy, but I had a lot more friends than I had enemies. Because you surround yourself with people you know were... That's the advantage in being in a city like New York. You can find a place to be comfortable among you, especially among those who had like dreams. You know, it was wonderful.
What are some of the most memorable roles you've sung on stage?
Oh my goodness! well, I would have to say my most favorite role would be Azucena in Il Trovatore. Verdi. And it's because, as my mother said when I was about 8 or 9, I'm not sure now, and I did Little Red Riding Hood, she came up, and I'd never seen my mother cry. She said, "You were so wonderful, Miss Ludy." And I said, "What did I do, Mama?" She said, I believed you." And she was convinced from that day forward that I belonged on a stage. We did nothing about it because we couldn't. But she would take me to great speakers. There was a female minister, African-American, of course, that I thought was just the most amazing person. And indeed she was. She inspired me, inspired a lot of people. She would take me to things like that, or she would take me to concerts of great artists who would come through Texarkana, because I went to school in a town not too far from there.
Now, in the film, in When I Rise, a documentary about your life, you describe also a special connection to the role of Carmen. And I think the quote from the film is that she did what she needed to survive. Was singing Carmen a personal turning point for you at all?
Carmen is your dream role. You get to be all the things you want to be in life. Beautiful, sexy, smart, you know, a leader, which is my nature. All those things. And she's a strategist, you know, she's very smart. I like smart ladies. I like smart people, I must confess. I like mingling with them, shall I say. Because I came from that kind of family, so a little bit of a snob. Just a little bit.
Well, the University of Texas brought you back in the 1980s as a distinguished alum.
Back up from there, because I really came back in 84.
Yeah.
Priscilla and Peter Flan set up this incredible, I don't know what to call that, welcome back, Barbara, kind of thing, at my favorite place on campus, which is Littlefield House. And everybody was concerned about how that was going to go. I wasn't. By this time, I'd been so many places in the world that were far more dangerous than Texas. But they were so welcoming, and smart to bring along people they knew I would be comfortable with. The Dorseys, for example, Bob and Angelina Dorsey. He's one of the people who recommended me for the Distinguished Alumnus Award. I had a good time. I wasn't still convinced that I would want to come back. But then later on, I was called by Roy Vaughan to tell me that I was being nominated for this award. And suddenly, time whisked by, and I realized my mother was getting older, my father was already deceased, and it would be the opportunity to be in a position where they could feel great pride. I turned down a 3-year contract in Hamburg to do so. My manager was absolutely livid. But Mama was not going to get to see something like that. She wasn't going to Hamburg. She wasn't going to be traveling there to see my work, or to London, or to Austria, wherever. And that was important. And indeed it was.
And so how did you feel upon your return here?
To Austin?
Yes.
Not much of anything. For me, when I'm going into something I'm not sure of, there's a part of my brain that just will just see what this is. I was somewhat amused with all of the security. I was thinking, whoa, have I become a terrorist overnight? No, I didn't say that at all. But it was rather overwhelming. And it turned out to be a venue in which I could be my best self as a performer. That was important. It was a great evening.
Have you ever sung the role of Dido since then?
But not because I was angry at the whole world about Dido and Aeneas, but because in truth, as I developed as an artist, it was not the ideal role for my kind of voice. Mine is a much lower range in timbre and color. I could have. I was offered it enough times. I didn't particularly want to.
Now, I'm so glad that you talk in the film and that you're wishing to share your love of spirituals, too, because they really, I mean, they have such power, I think. And I was wondering if you could share with me your love of them, you know, maybe take us back to childhood for just a second.
Well, spirituals don't go back to my childhood. I wasn't singing spirituals in my childhood.
Okay.
Little bitty girl, no. Because I really started singing when I was about, I'm told by my Aunt Maggie, where I lived in West Texas, in Quanah, Texas. I used to sing every Saturday night because my uncle, her husband, would bring over his old buddies and have their beer, and I would sing in my little, what do you call those little dresses? Pinafore. Exactly. Thank you. And so that's where I made my big debut. And she would, every single Saturday morning, would get my hair done. And every single Saturday evening, I would sing for their cronies. It was great. But the whole being surrounded by music all the time didn't necessarily mean I was going to sing spirituals right away. First of all, spirituals are composed for the most part.
Yes.
And I wasn't looking at composed music at that age. So it was probably... I can tell you exactly when spirituals became an essential part of my life that I was so conscious of. And that was about the second year in living in New York City. I suddenly realized I'd been working on French art songs and German Lieder and Spanish songs and all kinds of things, and I missed my music. And I started singing them, and I never stopped. after that.
Is there an element of faith for you that comes into it as well?
Oh, absolutely. Guide my feet, Lord, is something I wake up in the morning. Those are my first words. Sometimes I sing them, but not often, because you don't sound that good first thing in the morning. But that's one of my most favorite spirituals.
Beautiful. Ms. Conrad, thank you very much for sharing time with me. So I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. And I'm thrilled to be back. I am. I'm extremely appreciative of AT&T's involvement here. I don't have the wherewithal to go around the world and preach about much of anything. But when you partner with an organization like this and with people clearly caring about these things, then you have power to... I can sing much longer because I have a partner. It's hard work. And at one point in your life, you have to earn a living and make sure you do that. And I thought, oh, I didn't want to get in a classroom. I don't belong there. My mouth is too big.
You got to share it with the great.
Visiting is great. Yeah. Or going out and be a spokesperson. I love working one-on-one. Rochelle is one of those students. She's amazing. And I hope you will hear her soon. I don't belong in a classroom all the time because I understand my personality now. It needs a big stage. The fact that I was born at the time I was, and I am now 5 feet. No, I'm not 5'9" anymore. I'm 5'7" and 3/4". But I'm a big woman and a big personality. You have to put them in the right place, or you just spinning your wheels.
Wow. Thank you again very much. You're welcome. I really appreciate it.